This is edition number 2029 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday, the 7th of August, 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today, we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 6th of August, 2026. My name is Adrian Allenby, and my fellow readers are
Cynthia Gosling,
Kate Harris,
and Christine Barraclough.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5:30 and will set at about 8:30.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes World War I airfields in Norfolk, friends who became family, awfully fast spiders, and some audiobook advice from our resident librarian.
But we begin with the main news items, which include anguish over school bus passes, the changing of the flags, huge debts at a Broad's pub, and flooding from a 20-year-old leak. Let's start with those lead stories.
Children in a Norfolk village have been told they are not eligible for a free school bus pass, even though their older siblings living in the same house are. The extraordinary situation has arisen in Cawston, where parents have been applying for the passes for their 11-year-old children, who are due to start at Reefham High in September. They have been told by Norfolk County Council officials that they are not in the catchment area for free passes, even though their older siblings, who are already at the school, have passes. The authority says it has not changed its eligibility rules since the passes were given to the older children and has not been able to explain why their younger siblings will not receive one. It believes an update in the software used to calculate how long it would take children to walk to school may have shaved time off the journey. In two cases, parents have been told the walk to school is now a minute less than when it was calculated for their older children 2 and 3 years ago. It has said it will not be revoking passes from children who already have them, but the families are furious and say there have been no changes to the route their children will have to take, which involves an unlit footpath which runs alongside open fields under the cover of trees. Sophie Raven's two daughters have both been given free school transport within the past 5 years. But her son, who lives at the same address and is due to go to Reefham High in September, has been rejected. This is ludicrous. None of us can understand what the reasons are. The rules haven't changed. We haven't moved. She says the walking route proposed by the council is unsafe. While it might be fine in the summer, when the dark mornings and afternoons get here in the winter, it will be terrifying for young people to use that route. I would never walk miles down a rural, unlit footpath in the dark on my own. Carly Walton, who lives near the High Street, said the decision had created unnecessary stress ahead of the move to high school. Half of the pupils in the village have been awarded free transport, while the other half have been rejected. We are talking about mere metres being the difference, less than an extra minute of walking time. A council spokesman said, "Any parent who has transport refused can appeal the decision if they wish." Sanders Coaches has confirmed that an annual pass for that particular route would cost £795 per person, a weekly pass which the children would need for 38 weeks during the school calendar would be £14 per week for a total of £532 per year.
North Norfolk's Liberal Democrat-controlled council says it plans to remove Union Jacks put up by flaggers on Cromer Seafront. The authority has said it intends to take down the banners from lampposts on the town's clifftops. It says the flags will be replaced by its own civic banners, although it has declined to say whether these will be national flags or other symbols. The union flags have been fixed to lampposts by the group behind the Flagman UK Facebook page. Some have already been taken down by members of the public, but the group have returned to the seafront and put up new ones. The scenes are reminiscent of those which played out over several weeks last summer as Operation Raise the Colours swept the country. This grassroots campaign saw Union Jacks and St George Crosses put up on lampposts and street furniture in communities across Norfolk. While they were welcomed by many people as symbols of national pride and unity, others claimed the activity was antagonistic and designed to intimidate and try to take them down or stop them being flown. This led to several angry clashes. Flaggers in Cromer posted footage of one confrontation in the town earlier this month between one of the group and a member of the public. On the Flagman UK Facebook page, the group wrote, "You can tear them down, but we'll always come back. One England, one union, one team." The support today has been incredible. People stopping to chat, taking flags, joining in and lending a hand. That's what community is all about. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, said it had been contacted by members of the public concerned about the flags being cable-tied on council-owned street lighting. The spokesman said, "We are in the process of creating our own civic banner route along the Marham's Path, high-quality materials which will not degrade in the way the cheap, poor-quality flags currently in place are doing." It is important to recognise that working on the highway or alongside adopted public rights of way is a highly regulated activity, primarily under the New Roads and Street Works Act and other legislation. Anyone carrying out such activity must have relevant permissions, qualifications, procedures in place to protect themselves, pedestrians, and any other traffic where relevant. Any accidents, however minor, which occur during inappropriate activity could result in significant legal and financial repercussions for anyone involved, beyond the personal impacts for any individual affected. This is therefore our primary consideration as a responsible local authority. We also do not wish to see our streetlights inappropriately climbed using ladders, potentially leading to greater maintenance liabilities for the council taxpayer.
The owner of a Broad's pub and restaurant put his company into liquidation, owing more than £75,000, less than 2 years after liquidating another company with debts of over £175,000. Narada Enterprise Limited, which traded as Narada Pub and Restaurant in Potter Heigham, appointed liquidators earlier this month after director Konstantinos Mantelaris said the business had become unsustainable. Mr. Mantelaris, known as Costa, was previously a director of two other companies linked to the River Thurne venue, located by Potter Heigham Bridge. One of his companies, the Narada Pub Limited, was liquidated in 2024, owing more than £175,000. Another, Narada Pub and Restaurant Limited, was formed in April 2024. Both are registered at the same Potter Heigham address and share the same sole director, Mason Mantelaris, 22, who took over both companies from Mr. Mantelaris. The 53-year-old told this newspaper earlier this month that all of the venue's staff had been paid, and it was just the big companies, such as water and energy suppliers, that the company could not afford to pay. According to its statement of affairs, Narada Enterprise Limited owed creditors more than £75,000. Its debts included £52,000 to energy suppliers E.ON UK and British Gas, each owed £26,000, and £8,000 to Anglian Water. The company also owed HMRC £10,000, of which £3,600 is expected to be paid using the company's estimated total assets available to preferential creditors. Meanwhile, the Narada Pub Limited, the company Mr. Mantelaris previously liquidated in September 2024, owed Anglian Water £100,000, Bank Anna Money £48,500, and E.ON Energy £20,000. The tax authority was owed £6,500, with £3,600 expected to be paid from the company's assets. The Narada shares its name with one of the Broad's distinctive wherry yachts. Earlier this month, Mr. Mantelaris told this newspaper, "I've been trying to step away from the business. There's no money in it. The utility bills outweigh what we make. Everything's got so expensive, it's not cost-effective to stay open. Not for me, anyway. All the staff and bills are paid, it's just the big companies that we can't afford to pay. It's not sustainable anymore, because of the increase in rent and alcohol, and people aren't coming out to spend any money. Tourism has gone right down. There's nothing you can do. You can't make people spend money."
A rural road in North Norfolk is underwater, as locals say a 20-year leak problem has still not been fixed. The leak, located on Clye Road, just past Holt, has been flooding the road and surrounding ditches for nearly 20 years, residents say. Locals have accused Anglian Water of years of delays and week-long road closures where nobody turns up, and claim it as a serious risk to drivers and motorcyclists. The latest major incident was reported at Christmas 2025, but locals say it was not repaired until March, leaving the road repeatedly saturated through the winter. According to Anglian Water's online check and report system, the leak is currently being worked on, but when visiting on Tuesday, August the 4th, no work was being done. One resident said Anglian Water regularly books week-long road closures on the stretch, only for no work to be carried out. "People just reopen the road. They have done this so often, this road is underwater," they said. They added that the situation is particularly dangerous during the current hosepipe ban, when drivers assume roads will be dry. "No one comes round these corners at 60 expecting water in the road during a drought, especially not a motorbike," they said. Anglian Water's online check and report said the current leak has been listed as job in progress, last updated on July the 2nd at 09:53 a.m. A new job appeared on August the 3rd at 7:43 p.m, marked as job open with the note, "We've logged the issue. We're assigning an engineer. One of our engineers will investigate within 3 days." Anglian Water said its operational teams were on the ground 24 hours a day during the current hot, dry spell. In a statement on leaks more generally, a spokesman said, "We understand concerns about leaks and the impact they can have on local communities. Our teams work around the clock to identify and repair leaks as quickly as possible, prioritising those that have the greatest impact on customers' water supplies and those resulting in the highest water loss. We currently have 245 people focused on finding and fixing leaks, including increased 24/7 standby and emergency response cover."
A stranded yacht sparked a rescue mission off the Norfolk coast. The yacht called Tegan suffered engine failure and steering problems around 5 nautical miles northeast of Haysborough on Saturday. Caister Lifeboat launched its all-weather boat at 3:24 p.m. and arrived on scene by 3:54 p.m. A crew member was put aboard to establish a tow, and the yacht was safely taken to Trawl Dock in Lowestoft. The yacht was secured alongside the pontoon by 7:54 p.m. before the lifeboat crew returned to station. A spokesman for Caister Lifeboat said, "A busy afternoon for the volunteer crew, responding to 2 separate incidents and helping to ensure everyone reached safety."
An 18-year-old has been banned from driving after crashing his car into a hedge while under the influence of alcohol. Joshua Krask has been disqualified from driving after his red Ford Fiesta hit trees and verges on Haysborough Road in North Walsham on July the 12th. Appearing at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court, he pleaded guilty to driving whilst over the legal limit of alcohol. Emma Pocknell, prosecuting, said, "A woman found a male crashed in a hedge. Police found a Ford Fiesta and both airbags were deployed. On the opposite side of the road, there was damage to the trees and verges." Krask recorded 44 micrograms of alcohol in 100 millilitres of breath, above the legal limit of 35 micrograms. Rob New, mitigating, said it was a relatively low reading and that Krask had only just turned 18 and was an inexperienced young driver. Martin Dupay, presiding magistrate, said it was a rather sad story and sufficiently severe because it was involved in an accident. Krask of Foxglove Close in North Walsham has been banned from driving for 16 months. He must also pay a £120 fine, victim surcharge of £48, and prosecution costs of £85.
The county's fire service is projected to overspend by more than £1 million due to a sharp rise in call-outs. Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service is facing a budget overrun of £1.062 million for 2026-27, on top of its nearly £43 million allocation, with the prolonged hot and dry weather largely responsible for call-outs nearly doubling. the service has already received nearly £700,000 in additional funding to handle the increased demand. New figures reveal fire engine deployments have risen by 73% over the past 5 years, spurred by extreme weather conditions, more water rescues, and increasingly complex incidents. The service, run by Norfolk County Council, defended its spending, stating it had the third lowest service costs in the country per population size. A service spokesman explained that 60% of frontline staffing is made up of external, on-call, or retained firefighters who respond to emergencies when needed. This has led to fluctuating costs due to increased demand, resulting in higher staffing costs and significant budget pressures. The overspend also includes critical overtime and standby costs to ensure adequate cover across the county.
A brand which has betting shops across Norfolk is planning to axe more than 100 stores. Betfred has shops in Dereham, Great Yarmouth, Norwich, Wroxham, Wyndham, Fakenham, King's Lynn and Hunstanton. It has been confirmed that 132 stores will be closed along with 600 jobs being at risk nationally as part of the closure by September. The company cited rising costs, including inflation, increased national insurance contributions and higher gambling taxes as factors behind the decision. Joe Whittaker, chief executive of Betfred, said, "We have tried hard to protect all our sites and the colleagues who work in them, but the combined impact of higher employer national insurance contributions, wage inflation, increases in gambling taxes, and wider economic uncertainty has left us with no choice. These are well-run shops, staffed by dedicated colleagues, and it is incredibly hard to see any of them close. But the current fiscal and regulatory environment has made it impossible to keep trading all our shops. The company has launched a consultation over the closures and will continue to operate around 1,100 shops nationwide."
Our next few news stories include an accomplished amateur golfer, an explosive row over music festivals, a sorry tale of beach huts, and upset locals over church plans.
Tracy Williamson completed a remarkable hat-trick of championship victories after winning the Eastern Region Senior Women's Championships at Barnum Broom, securing her third major title of this season. The highly accomplished amateur from Sheringham Golf Club carded a superb 3-under par 71 on the par 74 Penink course to claim the title ahead of women golfers aged 50 and over from Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Huntingdonshire, Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk. Williamson's outstanding round also established a new course record for the Penink course since its recent redesign. Already enjoying an exceptional season, Williamson has won the Norfolk Ladies County Championship for a record 10th time and added the Norfolk Senior Ladies Championship to her growing list of achievements. She is also a regular member of the England Senior Women's Team. Winning both the women's and senior women's county championships was a unique achievement, which I don't think has been done before, she said. To add this championship was the icing on the cake. Despite setting a course record, Williamson felt there was still room for improvement. "The par fives were the strongest part of my game," she said. even with a three-putt bogey on the fifth and a missed birdie putt on the 15th, I felt the round could have been even better. I've always liked playing at Barnum Broom because it tests every aspect of your game. The course was in fantastic condition, especially considering the long, hot, dry summer we've had. With three championship titles already secured in 2026 and international honours once again on the horizon, Williamson continues to demonstrate why she is one of England's leading women senior amateur golfers.
A deputy lieutenant of Norfolk has been caught up in an explosive row over claims that musical festivals she runs on her seaside farm descend into unofficial beach raves. Anna Mudeka has been accused by council officials of allowing her Waxham summer camp events to overrun and overspill onto the nearby beach. The officers also raise concerns about alcohol intoxication and the potential for illicit drug use at the festival. She has been running the music events at Poplar Farm, which she bought in 2021, and where she runs a summer campsite close to Waxham Dunes. Miss Mudeka, who is a musician herself, applied to North Norfolk District Council to host two more events there this summer. The first, Dance Music Day, is scheduled for August the 8th and is due to feature electronic dance music with laser shows. The other, World Music Day, on August 29th, features folk and other genres. Nathan Lawn, an environmental protection officer who objected to her application, said concerns have been raised about her previous music events involving alcohol intoxication and the potential for illicit drug use. He said these events have a history of exceeding their finishing time and numbers in attendance. They often result in unofficial raves spilling onto the beach, resulting in damage to the dunes from late-night fires and barbecues, as well as littering issues. At a meeting of the council's licensing subcommittee on Tuesday, Miss Mudeka accused Mr. Lawn of failing to support his claims. She said, "How can such allegations be made without supporting evidence? The objections are simply untrue." Miss Mudeka, who was born in Zimbabwe and has lived in Norfolk since 1994, said that she was particularly affronted by the claims, given her role as a deputy lieutenant. She said, "In January 2025, I was honoured to be appointed as Deputy Lieutenant of Norfolk. My area of speciality is music, culture and the arts. That appointment followed extensive vetting through government and the royal household, and the King has to sign off the appointment personally. This reflects the importance placed upon integrity, character and public service. For that reason, I take the allegations made against my professional reputation extremely seriously and feel personally insulted by these allegations." Mr. Lawn said there had been 10 complaints involving the farm and campsite since 2023. One allegation involved a DJ shouting that a music event could not be shut down, while another related to adults smoking cannabis in front of the children. Mr. Lawn alleged that when the events take place, reports of noise disturbances from the beach increase. But despite the accusations, councillors decided to overlook Mr. Lawn's objections and allow the events to go ahead. Peter Fisher, chairman of the meeting, said the claims were largely based on complaints which could not be fully verified. He added that they appear to relate to activities taking place outside Miss Madeika's premises. The two events are planned to take place on fields designated for activities on the campsite, which is only in operation for 5 weeks of the year.
It is a seaside romance that has endured for generations, weathering winter storms and shifting holiday trends alike. But are we now falling out of love with one of coastal living's most quintessential trappings, the humble beach hut? While wooden shacks still line our seafronts and sand dunes, the prices they can command has fallen for the second consecutive year running. New figures say Norfolk huts lost 13% of their value last year, a drop second only to West Sussex, which saw prices plummet by 35%. One place where hut owners have had more reasons to fall out of love with their pied-à-terre is Heacham. Occupants of the 100 or so properties tucked behind the sea defences have endured poor water quality and a hike in parking charges. West Norfolk Council had debated whether or not to sell the land the huts stand on before putting it on hold. But it then increased the ground rents for the plots from £200 to £700 and replaced 10-year leases with yearly agreements. As temperatures rose to 35 degrees centigrade last week, the car park at the village's North Beach was almost empty midweek, and there were few people on the beach, with even fewer sunning themselves in front of their huts. Villagers Jason and Lisa Sherman were opening a bottle of wine under a parasol in front of the wooden shed, which cost them the princely sum of £500 some 15 or so years ago. "Once upon a time, they were up to £30,000, said Mr. Sherman. "Now you'd be lucky to get £5,000 for one. No one wants to buy them." A few huts away, Sandy picked up her hut for peanuts in present-day terms. She said she had paid £100 three decades ago, but reckons her hut is today worth around £12,000, which is still a tidy return on £100. "I've known perfectly well we're not the North Norfolk coast. We love having our beach huts. I don't mind having a yearly lease." About five huts at North Beach are currently for sale. Faded estate agents' board suggests some have been on the market for some time. Prices range between £5,000 and £15,000, depending on location and condition. Current prices at Old Hunstanton are between £24,000 and £42,000. Although one, the size of a small bungalow, with electricity and water, is for sale at £125,000. One hut in Wells is up for £78,000. Those looking for a cheaper option could rent one for around £65 a day, which includes two deck chairs. Property firm Yopper says huts have seen an average price fall of just under 10% nationally over the last year, a far cry from when prices spiked during the post-COVID staycation boom. Its chief executive, Verona Frankish, said, "Whilst demand for beach huts remains strong, they're ultimately a discretionary purchase. In Norfolk, current prices are thought to be 29% below 2022 figures."
A church's plans to convert its community hall into flats and a shop have upset locals. The proposal by Cromer Parochial Church Council, PCC, to close its parish hall and turn it into accommodation has sparked dozens of objections. The PCC says it wants to reduce maintenance costs and manage its assets more efficiently by shutting the High Street Hall, which is 120 yards from St Peter and St Paul Church in the town centre. It has lodged its plans with North Norfolk District Council, but they have been criticised by locals and the town council. Those who have objected say the loss of the hall in Cromer's conservation area would leave the town without an important public meeting space. They have also raised concerns about the traffic implications of the conversion and the risk of the flats becoming holiday homes. Under the plans, a retail unit would take up about 75% of the ground floor at the northern end of the building, with access from Church Street. A ground floor flat would be created at the southern end, while two further first floor flats would also be accessed from Loudon Road via a new entrance door. Members of Cromer Town Council's planning committee said they were concerned at the loss of a well-used community asset, as there is no other large hall in the town for community use. Those concerns are echoed in objections posted by locals. One wrote, "I object to this application, which it will mean the loss of the only large hall available for community events, such as exercise classes, charity bazaars and craft fairs, Christmas lights events, the annual art exhibition and town meetings." Concerns that the planned shop unit would not be filled were raised in several objections. One local said, "There are already plenty of vacant retail units in the town, and creating more is not needed. The permanent loss of such a facility would reduce opportunities for community engagement, inclusion, and social cohesion." People have until July the 31st to comment on the application through North Norfolk District Council's planning portal.
Controversial plans for six new homes to be built in North Walsham have been revised following months of objections from locals. The proposals to build the properties on Norwich Road have been resubmitted to now include a BAT survey and address ecological and biodiversity concerns. Now in the fifth version of drawings, the application has been opposed by locals after each new submission. The newest version includes the demolition of existing barns, outbuilding and a house, as well as the construction of six new houses and 23 car parking spaces. Previous objections said several of the new homes will be out of character with the town, and neighbours are concerned with the scale of the project. Fears over loss of privacy were also highlighted, with direct neighbours saying their windows and gardens could be overlooked. Objections also highlighted that Norwich Road is one of the town's busiest roads, and the extra cars will add an area where traffic is already heavy. Pike Architecture and Construction, the agent of the development, said, "There may be understandable concerns from a neighbour to propose new housing next door, but care has been taken to minimise the impact."
A village railway station has reached a historic milestone after 150 years of service. Gunton Station on the Bittern Line in Norfolk first opened in 1876. A celebration was held at the station and nearby Suffolk Arms, with guests including MP Stephen Aquarone and station volunteers. David Pearce, chairman of the Bittern Line Community Rail Partnership, said, "It is remarkable that the station and the majority of its original buildings survived, as in 1960s, there was a strong possibility of the railway's closure as part of the Beeching report. Thankfully, the line survived this and another closure threat in the early 1980s. And since the formation of the Community Rail Partnership 30 years ago, has seen passengers' journey quadruple to over 825,000 in 2025. Built for Lord Suffield of nearby Gunton Hall, the station once hosted royal visitors and featured a private waiting room. Today, it serves more than 35,000 passengers annually. Martin Halliday, Development Officer at Community Rail Norfolk, said, "We are delighted to be at Gunton today, marking 150 years since the station first opened."
A new specialist bin has been brought to a North Norfolk beach in a bid to prevent fires. The designated disposable barbecue unit has been put in place at Backton. It will provide a safe place for those choosing to grill on the beach to dispose of their equipment. The move comes in the same week that a bin on Backton Beach caught fire and melted after someone discarded a disposable barbecue. The fire on Coast Road saw crews from North Walsham called in to tackle the flames. County Councillor for North Walsham East, Lucy Shires, said, "A small change that will make a big difference at Backton Beach. A few weeks ago, a resident got in touch after regularly finding disposable barbecues buried in the sand during their early morning beach cleans. And they asked whether a dedicated barbecue disposal bin could be installed to encourage people to dispose of them safely, rather than leaving or burying them on the beach. I'm pleased to say that, following those conversations, a barbecue disposable bin has now been installed at Backton Beach, alongside a replacement litter bin."
A 15th century pub is to reopen this month under new management, who are committed to keeping it open for the local community. The Crown in Smallborough will relaunch on Monday, August the 17th, as a joint venture between Mike Deal, owner of nearby Wildcraft Brewery, and Darren and Julie Frost. The team aims to create a welcoming hub for the whole community, with Mr. Deal emphasising that the pub will remain independent and not become a Wildcraft pub. "This is a genuinely joint venture between the three of us," Mr. Deal said. "Wildcraft will be represented on the bar, but the Crown will have its own identity. It is first and foremost a village pub, and our priority is making sure it remains open and serves the whole community." The new team aims to preserve the pub's character while offering a balanced selection of drinks, including locally brewed wild craft drinks. Mr. Deal added, "The Crown is a fantastic building with centuries of history, but what really matters is its place within the community today. Village pubs are about much more than food and drink. They bring people together. We cannot wait to welcome everyone back and begin the next chapter of the Crown's story." You are listening to edition number 2029 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 7th of August, 2026. Still to come, there are items about UFOs and killer whales, and, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, a letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Paul Milner of Sheringham writes, "It beggars belief to hear Anglian Water commiserating with its customers about the hosepipe ban, adding they are on the case fixing pipe leaks. Why so? Nationally, the water utilities lose over 1 trillion litres of water each year through leaking pipes, about 20% of Britain's water supply. All is not lost, however, since Met Office data confirms Britain has become steadily wetter, albeit our rainfall is more extreme. The rain has not gone away, it just arrives in a different way. All we need now is for the water utilities to get their act together, fix the leaks, and build more reservoirs. No ifs, no buts. Water is essential to life, so maybe if Mr. Burnham can tear himself away from his Mancunian number 10, he might get stuck into something relevant to everyone. Mandate for new reservoirs to be built, and fine water utility bosses every week that they fail to fix identified water leaks. And now to this week's obituaries.
Ingrid Sonia Farrow, known as Bobby of Sheringham, passed peacefully at Kelling Hospital on Tuesday, July the 14th, 2026. A loving mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, and a dear friend to many. A celebration of her life will be held at Sheringham Golf Club on Saturday, September the 26th, 2026, commencing at 1 p.m. Dress code, smart casual. Those wishing to attend may contact Adrian Farrow at addy@farrow-rm.com. And tributes have been paid to a kind and selfless lifeboatman who helped promote a town's life-saving heritage. Frank Muirhead, who died recently, was an honorary curator at the RNLI Henry Blogg Museum in Cromer for many years. The museum said he shared his wealth of knowledge and enthusiasm with colleagues and visitors. He was instrumental in shaping the collection and endlessly promoted the life-saving work of the RNLI. It said, Mr. Muirhead joined in 1973 as crew and was awarded a certificate of thanks by the RNLI for his role in rescuing 2 fishermen in 1981.
And now some local events. On Sunday the 9th of August, there is a car boot sale at the Dereham Rugby Football Club, Eaglesham Park, Dereham, starting at 9 a.m. with barbecue, hot and cold refreshments available. Also on Sunday, a classic car show and village fete will be held in Necton, running from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Contact 07753 312 956. On Friday the 14th of August, you could attend the Winterton Craft and Gift Fair, open from 10 a.m. at the Church Room, Winterton on Sea. Contact 07359 875 031. Also on Friday, the Wind Energy Museum will hold an open day starting at 10 a.m. There will be historic wind-powered machines, working demonstrations of Norfolk's drainage history, full-size wind pumps, children's activity, a model museum, and tea room. Entry is £5, children £3. Tours will start at 11:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. This is all located at the Wind Energy Museum, Staithe Road, Reps with Bastwick. NR29 5JU. Contact 07796 407 864. And looking further ahead, to celebrate the 700th anniversary of Tunstead Church, there will be a Barbie quiz on Saturday, the 22nd of August, from 4 until 7 p.m, when we will be hosting a table quiz and barbecue. Adult tickets are £10 and under 16s are £5, which includes your quiz paper, barbecue, salads, dessert, tea or coffee, and live music. Held in the beautiful, tranquil grounds of St Mary's Church, NR 12 8HU. Please call 01603 736 155 to book. We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we learn how World War I changed the Norfolk landscape, hear how friends became family, discover just how fast spiders can run, and take our monthly trip into Book Corner.
For our first magazine article, we hear from Derek James as he reports on a new two-volume book covering Norfolk's wartime airfields. This item was published in the EDP of the 20th of June 2026. It was in January 1915 when the first Zeppelin raids took place over Norfolk, causing death and destruction. Zeppelin L3, crossing the coast at Sea Pauling, headed overland towards Great Yarmouth, where it spent barely 10 minutes, but during its attack dropped 11 bombs, a combination of high explosives and incendiaries. The raid killed two people, Martha Taylor and Samuel Smith, the first casualties of aerial bombardment in the land. At the same time, Zeppelin L4 was heading north around the coast, delivering bombs to several towns and villages along the way. Just before 11 o'clock that evening, it arrived at King's Lynn, where the airship dropped 8 bombs, killing 2 people, Percy Goat, aged 14, and Alice Gaisley, injuring 13 others, as well as causing £7,000 worth of damage. As Gary Rossin writes in his new two-volume book, The Archaeology of Norfolk's First World War Airfields, the reaction to the raids, both locally and nationally, was twofold. The initial shock inflicted by these first terror weapons soon turned to outright anger against the British authorities for allowing the attacks to get through. Precisely the results the Germans had hoped for, he writes. The local population of King's Lynn petitioned that the town should have its own artillery and aeroplane to defend against future raids. The attacks had shown it was not enough to have aircraft or artillery in place, but a cohesive communication network was also required to coordinate these assets. Local and national newspaper pressure, combined with that of local MPs, such as King's Lynn's Holcombe Ingleby, ensured that the defences would be fortified. Strengthening forces to repel German air attacks offered a psychological sign to the British public that their defence was being taken seriously. But it also played into German hands, as vitally needed British resources would have to be detained at home rather than used at the front, writes Gary. Notwithstanding this challenging decision, The number of airfields increased significantly along the eastern coast, with Norfolk seeing an appreciable growth. While Great Yarmouth had been the county's only operational airfield at the start of the war, by the summer of 1915, new airfields were being developed at Bacton, Borough Council, Holt, Narborough and Sedford. These new landing grounds, often around 50 acres in size, would form the vast majority of Britain's home defence airfields. Although Norfolk is widely associated with the airfields of the Second World War, the author demonstrates how the county's aviation story began much earlier. By the end of the First World War, there was an extensive network of aerodromes, landing grounds, training stations, and specialist facilities which played a vital role in defending Britain and supporting aviation operations on the Western Front. The new books, which are sold together, tell us in detail the story of how the technology of aviation transformed the landscape of Norfolk at a time of war. Volume 1 examines the origins and rapid development of military aviation and explores the architecture of these temporary but highly innovative sites, many of which have now disappeared from the landscape. While Volume 2 offers the reader a comprehensive gazetteer of Norfolk's First World War airfields with location references, maps, and documentary sources, and where appropriate, these sources are expanded by use of the Poppyland Publishing website with mapping features. The Archaeology of Norfolk's First World War Airfields by Gary Rossin is published by Poppyland Publishing at £29.95, sadly not yet available as an audiobook. The author was the director of the Sedford Historical and Archaeological Research Project for 10 years, one of the largest and longest-running independent research projects of its kind in the UK.
Next, we have the story of two strangers who became best friends and then discovered they were brother and sister. This article by Rowan Bridge was published on the BBC News website on the 24th of July 2026. Dave Green and Andrea Ermston found they instantly hit it off when their paths crossed while working in separate roles at Manchester Airport. The two strangers got on so well they could complete each other's sentences, which made sense when they discovered the truth. In 2005, Dave was managing the bus station at the airport and Andrea serviced the vending machines. Over the next 2 years, they became firm friends, texting and phoning each other when they were not at work. One day, during a phone call, Dave told Andrea something he had never mentioned before. He was adopted, and his birth name was Stuart Proudlove. "I kind of froze and didn't speak for a minute," said Andrea. Her maiden name was Proudlove, and she had a brother who was adopted before she was born. "It's not a very popular name, and it had to be him. Other than family, I had never heard that surname anywhere else," she added. She immediately rang her mother, Susan, to check her long-lost brother's birth date. They matched, 24th of March, 1966. She called Dave straight back. "I said, it's got to be you, it's got to be you. And I said, I need to see you. and so I went to pick him up, Andrea said. As they were driving to their mother's house, Dave realised where he was. They were driving along the bus route he used to cover before becoming a manager. His old route had taken him right past his mother's house and the school that Andrea had attended. He had been within touching distance of his birth family without realising. Susan said finally meeting Dave was a surreal moment. There were lots of tears. Then we just all hugged, said Andrea. I couldn't believe that I'd got my brother and my mum together. It was amazing. Andrea's mother had told her that she had a brother when she was younger. She told her he had been given up for adoption and had gone to a lovely lady who could not have children of her own. I immediately wanted to go and call him so we could play, Andrea said. Susan said that she had tried to find her son with the help of the Salvation Army, but had not got anywhere. I asked if we could go and get him back, Andrea said. She did explain that it didn't work that way. So I promised her that I would find him for her one day. On the mantelpiece in Susan's home was a picture of Dave as a baby. It had been sent by his adopted parents to his birth mother days after his adoption. The same photograph had also been displayed in his adopted parents' house. Dave had known since he was 10 that he was adopted, because his adopted parents had shown him the paperwork. But he said he had a very happy childhood and had never harboured any desire to track down his birth mother. I didn't feel like I had to go searching or had any unanswered questions, he added. Susan, their mother, died recently, but both said they were glad she got to be reunited with her son. She was so desperate to find her son to make sure he'd really had a good life, Andrea said. My mum and dad, they separated, unfortunately, and so I went through a lot of hard times knowing that my brother was out there, but I didn't know where. The pair said they were now making the most of the time they have together after moving in with each other in Kidsgrove, Staffordshire. Finding each other was, they said, their lottery win.
Next, we hear from James Woodford as he discovers how fast arachnids can run. This article was published on the 30th of June 2026 in the New Scientist magazine. Those of you with a nervous disposition may wish to fast forward over this item, as these spiders are frighteningly fast. So, here goes. A huntsman spider, found in Queensland, Australia, has been crowned the fastest spider in the world, with a top speed of nearly 3.6 metres per second, according to a global study of arachnid sprinting prowess. Currently, the official world record is held by a Moroccan flick-flack spider, which can hit speeds of 1.7 metres per second when it is startled, using a rolling, tumbling motion. But some experts regard this as incorrect. The flick-flack has a special type of locomotion, says Jonas Wolf at University of Greifswald, Germany. It is not running, and it only works downhill on sand dunes. To get a comprehensive picture of running speed in spiders, Shreyas Kuchibotla at Imperial College London and his colleagues, including Wolf, collected 162 live spider species during fieldwork throughout the UK, North America, Southern Europe and Australia, along with dozens of specimens sourced from pet shops. Each of these was carefully weighed, then tested for their speed on A4 or A3 grid paper, in an attempt to understand the biomechanics across as many species as possible. Most species were coaxed into running by gently touching them with a paintbrush, but others were not so cooperative, says Coochie Bottler. This project would have been over in a month if spiders could understand English, he says. Tarantulas aren't built for running. They'd much rather stand their ground. So we had to be blown at with puffs of compressed air. Coochie Bottler and his colleagues also collected speed recordings of a further 96 species made by other research teams. The 3-gram jungle huntsman spider was clocked at 3.59 metres per second by Christopher Clement and his colleagues at the University of the Sunshine Coast in Australia. These spiders can achieve such high speeds because they are relatively large as far as spiders go, but not large enough that their legs get overburdened by a heavy abdomen, says Clement. In general, bigger spiders tended to be faster, but some are much faster than expected for their size. The biggest surprise was the orange goblin spider, which weighs a mere 0.1 milligrams, but moved at over 20 centimetres per second. Nothing could have prepared me for how it practically teleported across the arena, says Coochie Bottler. David Labonte, a team member at Imperial, says speed is, in principle, entirely determined by physics. But it is lifestyles such as hunting strategies that drive the evolution of extreme anatomical and physiological adaptations, he says. A cheetah, say, comfortably outruns most similarly sized dogs. This is, of course, because its lifestyle has made this speed beneficial. But it is still dictated by physics, says Labonte. After accounting for both body size and shared ancestry, the team's conclusion is that fast running is associated with relatively longer legs, but not with leg slenderness, or, surprisingly, whether a spider lives its life upside down or not. Leander Mazin at Edith Cowan University in Perth, Australia, says long legs appear to be a spider's speed gear. The huntsman supplies the record book hook, but the deeper discovery is that spider speed is shaped by leg architecture and evolutionary history, not simply by size or whether a spider spins a web, says Mason. This article did include a number of images which, on reflection, we have decided not to describe for you.
In this month's book corner, Mardler librarian Lorna Wilson has identified a selection of novels themed around summer. The Midsummer Murders series by Caroline Graham seems an apt choice to begin with. The very first book in the series, in which we meet Chief Inspector Barnaby, is The Killings at Badger's Drift. This fictional village is home to Miss Bellringer, who insists that her friend Emily Simpson did not die of a heart attack, but was in fact murdered. An autopsy soon proves she is right, as a mix of red wine and hemlock is found in the dead woman's system. While the village descends into panic, the murderer strikes again, claiming the life of local birdwatcher Iris Rainbird. With eccentric villagers, shocking twists, and an unforgettable reveal, this is a classic whodunit that will have you mystified until the end. Next, let's head back to a 1930s summer to meet the Cazalet family in The Light Years by Elizabeth Jane Howard. This is the first book of the Cazalet Chronicles, which introduces the Cazalet family. We meet the extended family, the grandparents, their three sons plus their wives, children and servants, as they converge for two blissful summer months in the heart of the Sussex countryside. Safe from the advancing clouds of war, there are days of childish games, lavish family meals and picnics on the beach. Beneath the idyllic surface, we discover hidden anxieties and tensions. The remaining books in this sprawling family saga follow the fascinating tangle of their family affairs across two decades, with sweeping tales of love, loss, and resilience. My third book choice is an unusual novel, The Hopeless Life of Charlie Summers by Paul Tordai. We meet main character, Hector Chetwode Talbot, Eck to his friends, who has left the army after a rather nasty moment in Colombia. From a privileged background, he is slightly at a loss as to what to do next. He is approached by an old army pal, Bilbo, whose investment fund company is booming. This very readable novel subtly highlights the surprising parallels between obvious con men and the rest of us who just want to make an honest living. And finally, for something light-hearted, there is Summer Moonshine by P.G. Wodehouse. Sir Buxton Abbott is the owner of Walsingford Hall, deemed one of the least attractive stately homes in the whole country. In order to maintain this unattractive stately home, Sir Buxton must take in paying guests. So he is overjoyed when a rich, if not very nice, continental princess considers buying it. Meanwhile, his daughter finds romance with a playwright. Thus begins a complicated love quadrangle involving broken engagements and lost fortunes. This is an enjoyable cocktail of humour, love, confusion, and funny characters. I hope some of these stories will keep you entertained throughout these halcyon summer days. All of these books can be borrowed from Caliber Audio Library on Memory Stick or listened to on the internet or using Alexa. You can also borrow or request these audiobooks or listen to them on the internet via Norfolk County Libraries. Whatever you choose to listen to this month, I do hope you enjoy it.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include heritage railway events, an open-air theatre, a family with passion for music, and a look ahead to Christmas.
Heritage railway journeys, vintage locomotives, and themed family experiences are steaming ahead in Norfolk. North Norfolk Railway is inviting visitors to step back in time with a full calendar of activities, dining trips and events running along the 5.5 mile line between Holt and Sheringham. This summer, the railway will feature the recently restored N2 locomotive, the oldest surviving engine designed by Sir Nigel Grisley, who is also known for the famous Flying Scotsman. The 105-year-old locomotive returned to service in July after an 8-year overhaul costing around £800,000. New for this year is the Poppy Line Pirates Treasure Trail, running from August the 1st to 21st, inviting young visitors to solve clues and uncover the hidden loot of Captain Madoc. Hannah Drury, Marketing, Fundraising and Visitor Experience Manager at North Norfolk Railway, said, "Weybourne was once famous for smuggling, and the trail allows visitors to see the trains, to travel between our three stations, solve the clues to obtain a secret code that will earn them a prize." The trail complements the railway's regular activity sheets and the What Can You Spot booklet, launched earlier this year for older children. To help meet demand, the railway has expanded its summer dining services, including cream teas on selected Sundays and Thursdays, and the new Brunch on Board experience on Sundays and Bank Holiday Monday. The end of the month sees the annual Festival on Rails, which runs from August the 22nd to 31st and celebrates the golden age of rail travel. General Manager Graham Hewkins added, "Our August lineup has something to suit all tastes and includes several locomotives and carriages that are unique to us. There's always a great buzz in the summer as we welcome locals, holidaymakers from far and wide, families, retired couples, and enthusiasts for a trip back in time." It comes as the railway has suspended its steam services as a precautionary measure due to the ongoing heatwave. North Norfolk Railway will run diesel locomotives instead of steam trains in response to the current extreme weather conditions and to assist Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service. The decision came after discussions with the fire service and follows a period of heightened wildfire risk. The railway has already implemented fire prevention measures and reported no significant lineside fires this season. For visitors still hoping to experience steam, an engine will remain in steam at Sheringham Station for footplate visits and moving up and down in the confines of the station for photographs.
From open-air theatre to Twilight Walls, a historic Norfolk estate has unveiled its events for the months ahead. Mannington Hall, a 15th-century moated estate near Aylsham, is welcoming visitors to its gardens and grounds throughout the summer and into autumn. With guided wildlife walks, outdoor theatre and family nature clubs, the schedule has something to offer for all ages to enjoy the estate in new and imaginative ways. David Horton Fawkes, Chief Executive of the Hall, said, "Preserving a historic estate like Mannington isn't just about protecting the past. It's about sustaining our beautiful grounds and gardens for the future." The team and I couldn't be more excited to welcome new and returning visitors to the estate this summer. Among the highlights is a nighttime wildlife experience called Nightfall at Mannington. An open-air performance of Charles Dickens' The Pickwick Papers, and foraging in the hedgerows with Britain's Botanicals. For younger visitors, the Mannington Minnows Nature Club returns, offering hands-on outdoor learning sessions throughout the summer holidays. The fun continues into early autumn, with the Mannington Book Bash in September, featuring talks, discussions, and signings from a lineup of acclaimed authors. Guests can also explore the estate's formal gardens, woodland walks, cafe, and family play area throughout the season. With our varied programme of expert-led workshops that lead us into autumn, we look forward to offering a space where visitors can spark their curiosity and explore our nature haven at their own pace. Mr. Horton Fawkes added, "Masterminded by Alan Power, the gardens at Mannington are looking even more beautiful this year and are a rich source of scent and colour. The newly designed play area makes a day at Mannington an even more enriching experience for families, and we hope that along with the range of walks on offer, visitors of all ages can enjoy a shared opportunity to connect with the great outdoors and with each other."
A family with a passion for music and mending is celebrating taking their business from a shed start-up to a new village base. After 4 years of growth, RJP Audio Overhaul, founded by electronics specialist Richard Peel, has moved into a business unit at Home Farm, Marsham. Last week, the company booked its 700th repair. The audio repair company began life in a shed in March 2021, before expanding into the family garage, where Mr. Peel and his wife Vanessa ran the business in the evenings and at weekends alongside their full-time jobs. Now, Mr. Peel works full-time for the business from the unit at Home Farm, with his wife handling invoicing and administration 2 to 3 days a week. RJP Audio Overhaul is very much a family affair. Vanessa's son, Kieran McMullen, looks after photography, while Mrs. Peel's brother, Mark Shriver, produces promotional literature. Mr. Peel's father, Sam, builds the wooden benches used for servicing and customer product renovations. In today's world, where so much is discarded, we are proud to play a small part in reducing electronic waste, said Mr. Peel. By repairing rather than replacing, we help keep equipment out of landfill and contribute to a more sustainable future. Mr. Peel has extensive experience repairing hi-fi equipment from multiple brands, including Yamaha, Denon, Jay's Audio, Macintosh, Aiwa, and more. Richard founded our audio repair business due to his passion for the product and the pleasure of seeing the owners' reactions to their fully functional products again, Mrs. Peel said. "We believe that repairing is often the better choice for both our customers and the environment." Since starting the business, Mr. Peel has repaired audio equipment dating back to the 1960s, including systems that have been owned for decades or inherited from loved ones. "In today's world, where so much is discarded, we are proud to play a small part in reducing electronic waste," said Mr. Peel. "By repairing, rather than replacing, we help keep equipment out of landfill and contribute to a more sustainable future."
With the ongoing heat waves hitting the region, Christmas may be far from most people's minds. But in North Norfolk, an award-winning attraction's promise of twinkling lights and festive cheer might offer some relief from the summer sun. Thursford has announced that tickets are now on sale for its 2026 Christmas events, including the return of Santa's Magical Journey and the Enchanted Journey of Light. Santa's Magical Journey takes visitors through a winter wonderland filled with animatronic animals, elves, and festive creatures, While The Enchanted Journey of Light features more than 1,000 illuminated lanterns and a vibrant outdoor light trail. George Cushing, operations manager at Thursford, said, "Following huge customer interest, we're pleased to announce our Christmas events for 2026. We always strive to make the Enchanted Journey of Light bigger and better, and this year we're investing in new themed lanterns, creating a new area for customers to explore. More details on this will be revealed later this year. Plus, new props are being added to Santa's magical journey to add even more magic. These events sell out every year, so we advise booking in advance to avoid disappointment. Santa's magical journey tickets include entry to the Enchanted Journey of Light, offering better value for money for families with small children. Those who want to enjoy the lights without a Santa visit can purchase separate tickets for the Enchanted Journey of Light, which includes walking through Fantasyland, bypassing Santa's workshop. Thursford's Adventure Playfair will also be open during the Christmas events with an additional charge. The large vintage fairground-themed play park will be decorated as part of the illuminated experience. Thursford's Christmas events will run from November the 21st to December the 24th, with tickets available at www.thursford.com or by calling 01328 878 477. Prices start at £18 for adults and £25 for children. Relaxed sessions with reduced lighting, music and visitor numbers will take place on Sunday, November the 29th.
Two RAF pilots claimed to have seen a UFO off the coast of Norfolk. The sighting, which was highlighted last week by the UK Air Prox Board, is said to have occurred during an air-to-air refuelling mission over the North Sea at Cromer in February. The UK Air Prox Board reports on incidents to improve air safety, covering near misses and unidentified objects. One of the pilots in the tanker ducked as the object whizzed by. The other pilot in the fighter jet, which was being refueled, also claimed to have seen the unidentified object. It is reported that the object missed the two RAF planes by just 100 to 150 feet. The refueling mission was taking part at 16,000 feet at the time. Whatever the mysterious object was, it did not appear on the pilot's radars as it shot past them at the time. It comes after a revelation at Gatwick Airport, which saw a pilot claim to see a flying saucer on their landing approach.
4 days of fun are on the way for families as a new event prepares to arrive in Hoveton. Bounce Town, taking place at Hoveton Village Hall, playing field, from August the 20th to the 23rd, features more than 14 giant inflatables, characters meet and greets, and a selection of food and drinks. Adam Coulton, event organiser, said, "As a local family business, we're passionate about creating events that bring people together. Bounce Town isn't just about bouncy castles. It's about giving children a chance to laugh, play and make memories, while parents can spend quality time together without travelling miles for a great day out. We really hope local families will come along, support the event and enjoy everything we've put together." Each ticket includes a 3-hour play session. Organisers are working with local businesses to create a community feel, with food and drink available throughout the event. Bounce Time is created by Hyperactivities, a local events company.
A lifeboat crew was called out to recover an inflatable of a killer whale. Haysborough RNLI's Russell Pickering crew was alerted at 2:12 p.m. on Wednesday, July the 29th, to reports of an inflatable floating off Eccles Beach. When the crew located the inflatable with no one on board, they realised it was a blow-up orca. They began a shoreline search to check no one had fallen off it. After confirming that no one was missing or in danger, the crew returned to the station and prepared for their next call-out. Chris Risby, a member of the crew, said, "This was a call-out with good intent. If you see anything that looks out of place or you think there is someone in trouble or danger, then call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard. We are happy to check things out." The water safety team has advised the public not to use inflatables in the sea, as winds can take swimmers out to sea so quickly. If you take one to the beach and it floats out to sea, then please call the Coast Guard and tell them, the spokesman added.
A rare solar eclipse is plunging Norfolk into darkness next week, treating stargazers to one of 2026's standout celestial events. On August the 12th, the moon will pass in front of the sun, leaving only a tenth visible, marking the most dramatic solar eclipse in the UK since 1999. The entire nation will witness this celestial event, with at least 90% of the sun's surface obscured. The eclipse is expected to last for around 1 hour and 48 minutes. In Norwich, the partial eclipse will start at 6:15 p.m, reaching its maximum at 7:11 p.m, before ending at 8:04 p.m. The sky won't become totally dark, but it will look like a cloudy day or later in the evening than it actually is, and the temperature may feel slightly cooler. Anyone planning to watch the eclipse must never look directly at the sun without certified eclipse glasses or suitable solar filters, even when most of the sun is covered. Normal sunglasses do not protect your eyes during the phenomenon. The last partial eclipse in Britain was in March 2025, when only 30 to 40% of the sun was obscured. This is the most coverage seen from the UK in 27 years, since a total solar eclipse in Cornwall and Devon.
Our last few articles cover boxing hares, a centenarian's day out, a timber lighthouse, and the cost of ice cream.
A pair of brown hares have been captured on camera squaring up to each other on the Norfolk coast. The footage from Blakeney Point of the animals boxing was recorded by a National Trust trail camera used to monitor a ringed plover nest near a former lifeboat house on the nature reserve. A small team of rangers is resident during the nesting bird season from April 1st to August 31st. A spokesman from the Broads and Sheringham National Trust said, "Brown hares are a common sight in fields throughout North Norfolk. It is less common to see them this close to the shoreline, but not unheard of. When walking along the coast, visitors can help by paying close attention to where they are walking, as nests can be hard to spot and eggs often blend in with a shingle or sand. The dramatic boxing behaviour is most often seen from March through to July, when males can be a little too persistent in pursuing females. The spokesman added that boxing usually occurs when a male, buck, is being too persistent with a female, doe. When she's had enough of his advances, the doe will try to fend him off, and that's when you see the brown hares standing up on their hind legs in this boxing-like stance. The clip also shows a ringed plover reacting as the hares come close to its nest. Visitors are urged to stick to paths, avoid fenced-off areas, and keep dogs away from nesting zones to ensure Norfolk's hares and shorebirds can continue to put on a show undisturbed. Some of the best places to spot brown hare in Norfolk include Granborough Hill, Warren Marsh, Clyne Marshes and surrounding arable fields, Martham Broad and nearby Broads Marshes.
A 103-year-old woman has enjoyed a nostalgic day out. Violet Webb, who lives at St Mary's Care Home in Crosthwick, returned to Caister Lifeboat Station more than 30 years after retiring nearby with her late husband Stuart. The visit was organised by Lauren Neild Keeley, the care home's activities coordinator, and brought back many happy memories for Violet, who with her husband was a friend and supporter of the lifeboat crew. Miss Neild Keeley said, "When I first met Violet, I had come to St Mary's from working in Caister, and when I got to know her, I learnt that she had moved to Caister with her husband later in life. We spent many afternoons discussing the village, and she shared her memories of living there and how they enjoyed friendships with the crew and supporting Caister Lifeboat. I told her how they had just been fundraising and had a new boat delivered and how they were upgrading their cafe to make it accessible and to have a viewing station for the boat and the beautiful coastline. She said it sounded wonderful." During her visit, Violet enjoyed tea in the lifeboat's cafe and spoke with joint coxswain Owen Nutt. She also visited the memorial to her friend Roland Benny Reed, a former coxswain who died in a maroon accident in 1991. Violet, a mother of three, served in the Land Army during the Second World War. She met her husband during that time and the couple married in 1949. The Webbs retired to Caister in 1988 after years of family holidays in the area. In 2011, they moved back to Northamptonshire to be closer to family. Stuart died shortly after the move and Violet returned to Norfolk in 2019 with her son Bill and his wife Aileen.
An architect has outlined bold plans to build a 42-metre timber lighthouse on the Norfolk coast. Alex Scarshell wants to create the structure on Beacon Hill, near East Runton. The Sapiens Garden plan, which is in its very early stages, would see the lighthouse surrounded by a garden of memory. A circular landscaped garden made up of 77 trees, each dedicated to a significant cultural figure, from scientists to musicians and philosophers. Mr. Scarshell, who is Russian, said the idea grew from 15 years of building timber homes by hand and from friendships in the UK. "Great Britain is a country of beacons," he added, "so why not create a new one? Something that speaks both to history and to the future. This is one of the highest points in the east of England, and historically, It helped to guide and signal ships, Mr. Scarshell, 43, said. We are giving the hill back its old memory and its symbol. That feels to me both important and timely. Whilst still at an early stage, the proposal would see locally sourced materials used wherever possible, with English oak at the heart of the design. My soul is in love with wood, he said. The idea is that this lighthouse would be built from timber grown and worked here in England. We are already in early conversations with interested colleagues, and it promises to be fascinated. Before any Norfolk construction, a smaller prototype weather beacon is planned for Greenwich Park in London.
Some Norfolk seaside towns are scooping up better value than others, it has been revealed. A new study by credit card experts Zabel has revealed Cromer as one of the UK's cheapest spots for a scoop of vanilla ice cream, with an average price of just £2.73. The research compared prices at coastal destinations across the country and found that a day out at the seaside can come with very different costs at the ice cream counter. James Goforth, product manager at Zabel, said, while an ice cream might feel like one of the smaller costs of a family day out, our research shows that prices can vary dramatically depending on where in the UK you choose to visit. At the most expensive destinations, a simple treat for a family of four can cost upwards of £15 for a single scoop each. And that is before you factor in travel, parking, food, and everything else that comes with a day at the beach. Those small purchases add up faster than most people realise. A family of four in Cromer can expect to pay a total of £10.92 for single scoops or £16 for double scoops. Barton-on-Sea in Hampshire takes the crown as the UK's cheapest seaside ice cream spot at £1.95 per scoop. Tynmouth, £2.28. Ilthracombe and Portree, both £2.30. Saltburn, £2.37, and Whitby, £2.38, were identified as other budget-friendly locations. At the other end of the scale, Portmaddock in Wales is the priciest, with one scoop costing £3.85 on average. Mr. Goforth added, for families looking to make the most of their budget this summer, it is worth doing a little research before heading out. There is still excellent value to be found at the seaside. You just need to know where to look.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa Smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing this issue were Chris and Lorna Wilson. And do keep listening as immediately following this edition of the Mardler, you can hear items from the Talking News Federation. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!
DNF soundings. Features from across the UK.
And now here's Charlotte from Guide Dogs.
Hello, this is Charlotte from Guide Dogs, back with another update on our Buddy Dog scheme. This has been a very busy month in Buddy Dogs. Last week we ran an event in Newcastle for families with a buddy dog to get together. It was also an opportunity to invite families along who are considering whether a buddy dog is right for them. We had a range of activities for children and their families, including making dog treats, making a tug toy, and getting to meet a buddy dog in training and practice teaching them a trick. It was wonderful to meet the families with their dogs and hear about the positive impacts that their buddy dogs are having. I had a lot of fun teaching the children how to make the dog toys. For the children that did not have their own dog, I encouraged them to chat to the families also present and offer their toy to them, or to donate it to one of the dogs in training. For the older children present, we had a tech table to demonstrate a braille embosser, screen readers on phones and laptops, liquid level indicators, and a talk with a guide dog owner about assistive technology, which was very popular. We also had a dog health table where we had models of fleas, ticks and mites, as well as plastic moulds of dog's teeth for the children to pick up and examine. The most popular object on this table was the model lump of fat. This is a 2 kilo blob, and we asked the children and their parents to guess how much it weighs. Just like with qualified guide dogs, we are careful to monitor the weights of our placed buddy dogs, and sometimes holding the 2 kilo block of fat can really bring home how much excess it really is for a dog to be carrying. This has also been a successful month for placing buddy dogs, with 2 buddy dogs qualifying with their families in the southwest. I have also just placed a buddy dog with his potential family for his month-long trial, and this is going really well. The dog's name is Patrick, and he is a large yellow Labrador cross golden retriever. Patrick was deemed unsuitable for the guiding role as he did not like wearing the guiding harness, despite his trainer putting a lot of work into getting him used to it. Aside from this quirk, Patrick is a very easygoing boy. He is quiet, laid back, and walks really nicely on the lead. He is a big boy at 36 kilos, but a real gentle giant. I matched Patrick with an 8-year-old boy with total vision loss, who is also an ambulatory wheelchair user. We did a matching visit where the family came to the office to meet Patrick, and this went brilliantly. Patrick walked very calmly beside the boy's wheelchair, and at the end of the session, Patrick fell asleep with his head on the boy's lap. Patrick has now been living with the family for a week, and I am receiving lots of photos of him on various adventures. The family have reported that their son is much more confident to go out on walks to new places when Patrick is with him, and he is really enjoying having Patrick sleep on the end of his bed. I have a few families waiting to be matched with buddy dogs, but at the moment there aren't many dogs coming out of training for me to assess. This is great for guide dogs on the whole, as it means that we are getting more dogs qualified as guides, but I'm hoping that there will be a few dogs coming my way shortly. As always, thank you for listening, and I will be back soon with more stories from guide dogs.
Hi, I'm Bob Baker.
And I'm Jill Hardiker.
And together we are Sound and Vision,
bringing you the best information, technology and interviews for the visually impaired and those supporting them.
This time we're looking at travelling with a visual impairment. What help is available and how to book it? First of all, we looked at air travel.
The most important thing is preparation and making sure that your travel company is aware of your needs. Most airlines require at least 48 hours notice of this to make your travel experience smoother.
Over 75 airports globally, including 17 in the UK and Ireland, are covered by a company called ABM, who provide passenger services for travellers with reduced vision. Personnel are trained to describe the layouts of the surroundings, distances, stirs and obstacles using non-visual language.
They offer guiding and navigation with dedicated staff, providing sight guidance and verbally offering an arm or an elbow, which includes personal guidance and navigation from your arrival drop-off point to the departure gate. Assistance with navigation to the terminal, duty-free and security areas, and pre-boarding onto the aircraft. They can also help with retrieving luggage and navigating to your onward transport at your destination.
If you'd like to take your guide dog, ABM ensure service animals remain with the passenger, are safely processed through security, and have access to airport relief areas.
ABM integrates with programmes like the Hidden Disability Sunflower Lanyard Scheme, helping staff quickly identify and support passengers who have low vision or non-visible sight conditions. Visually impaired assistance with ABM or any other airport special assistance provider is completely free of charge.
ABM stand at the airport can offer help if needed and you haven't already booked. The good news is that UK airports and airlines are legally required to provide special assistance to people with disabilities who travel by air at no extra charge and with no proof of disabilities needed.
Next, we approach the Rail Delivery Group to find out about what assistance is available for visually impaired travellers on the trains. A Rail Delivery Group spokesman said,
"Making the railway more accessible is important so passengers can travel independently, safely and with confidence. We are working to improve the support available for people with accessibility needs, including those who are blind and partially sighted. We want a railway that works for everyone. To help make this happen, we are working with customers, accessibility groups, organisations supporting blind and partially sighted people, and our staff to make improvements across the network."
The statement continued to say that a range of support is already in place to help people travel more easily. Braille station maps to help blind and partially sighted passengers understand station layouts. Disability persons' rail cards give eligible passengers discounted fares on national rail journeys. Good Maps technology, which is available at certain stations, uses a phone app to give step-by-step audio directions inside stations, helping visually impaired passengers find their way independently. The Hidden Disabilities Sunflower Lanyard lets help staff know that a passenger may need extra help, time or support. Audio announcements on trains and in stations with clearer and simpler language introduced recently make information easier to understand.
Passenger Assist and Turn Up and Go offer help with things like boarding, changing trains or getting around the station, whether booked in advance or requested on arrival. Priority seating near the train doors, making it easier for the passenger who needs to sit close to the exit. Tactile paving along the platform edges, providing a textured surface to help passengers identify where the platform edge is safely.
For further information about National Rail Enquiries, Journey Planning and Passenger Assist, you can phone 03457 48 49 50, and that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, except Christmas Day. Or you could email customer.relations@nationalrail.co.uk.
Maybe you'd like to take a long distance trip by bus or coach. Most companies offer assistance to visually impaired travellers, and this is what we learned. We started with National Express, which has a dedicated assisted travel team service to support customers wishing to use their long-distance fleet of coaches. VI solo travellers can request assistance by filling in the online form or calling 037 17 81 8181, and that's from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. or by emailing the service team at addl@nationalexpress.com.
Next, we looked at Megabus UK, which offers free travel companions for eligible blind passengers and provides pre-booked boarding and station assistance. If you have visual impairments, you can request alternative journey formats like large print and notify the driver of your specific stop so they can alert you when you arrive. You can email enquiries at megabus.co.uk or you can call 0141 352 4444. And that's during business hours, which are Monday to Sunday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. They ask that you have your booking reference number ready if you have a query about an existing reservation. So what help is there for VI ferry travellers?
Ferry operators provide extensive assistance for blind and visually impaired passengers, including guided boarding, orientation, braille signage, and permission for guide dogs. By law, UK and EU ferry operators must provide this help for free, provided you request it in advance.
Staff can meet you at the terminal, help you navigate through the port, assist you during boarding and disembarkation, and help you locate seating or toilets. Crew members can guide you round the ship to familiarise you with the layout. Some UK operators, such as Whitelink, even use audio-described QR codes in terminals. Ships generally feature braille signage, tactile lift buttons, and frequent audible announcements for safety updates.
Registered guide dogs and assistant dogs travel completely free of charge and have access to passenger decks and facilities. Many operators like CalMic and Whitelink allow your fully sighted carer or companion to travel for free if you need dedicated assistance during your crossing.
You must notify the ferry company of your specific requirements when booking, or at least 48 hours before you travel. This allows staff to flag your reservation, arrange priority parking close to lifts if you're travelling with a vehicle, and ensure the correct number of crew are available to support you. You can check route details or pre-arrange your assistance on the operator websites. If you're using a travel agent, then they can do that for you.
Within the four countries of the UK, there are different ways of accessing help. Let's start with England. Blind and visually impaired travellers are eligible for free bus travel and discount train travel across England under the government-backed schemes.
Blind travellers in Wales receive substantial concessions, including free bus travel, discount on train tickets for you and a companion. These benefits are available if you are registered blind, or severely sight impaired, or partially sighted.
In Northern Ireland, the Registered Blind Smart Pass is a government scheme that grants eligible individuals free travel on public transport services. The scheme is funded by the Northern Ireland Concessionary Fares Scheme and applies to TransLink buses and rail services, as well as cross-border journeys into the Republic of Ireland.
Registered blind people are entitled to free travel on all TransLink bus and rail services, that's Metro, Glider and Ulster Bus, using a Registered Blind Smart Pass. This pass also offers free travel on rural dial-a-lift services and valid point-to-point cross-border travel, whilst partially sighted individuals are entitled to half-fare concessions.
You can pick up an application form in person at a manned TransLink bus or rail station. You can request the application form by phoning 028 9066 6630, or you can request one via email by sending your name and full address to smartpass@translink.co.uk.
In Scotland, the Scottish Thistle Assistance is a free initiative designed to make travelling on public transport in Scotland easier and more comfortable for anyone who needs a little extra help. You can use it on buses, trains, trams, planes and ferries across the country. There is the Thistle app or the Thistle card. Both options let you tell transport staff quickly and discreetly what kind of support you would like. For example, more time to get to your seat, or clearer, slower communication.
You can use the Thistle card on the CityLink, which provides an extensive network of express coaches connecting over 200 destinations across Scotland, including services to Northern Ireland and seasonal routes to Blackpool. The Seven City Network connects Scotland's major hubs, which are Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdeen, Dundee, Inverness, Perth and Stirling. In the Highlands and West Coast, it connects the Central Belt to rural and tourism destinations in the Highlands and Islands.
The Thistle card or app do not give you free discounted travel. For this, you would need to apply for an NEC, which is a National Entitlement Card, giving free unlimited standard class travel on registered local and long distance buses across Scotland. If your card has an I+1 symbol, a companion can travel with you for free on ScotRail services within Scotland. It also entitles you to free travel on registered local bus services and on standard class ScotRail services within Scotland. It also covers travel to and from Carlisle and Berwick-on-Tweed.
To apply for a Thistle card, email thistlecard@sestran.gov.uk or ring on 01 31 524 5153, or write to Thistle Assistance, SESTRAN 3D Bridge, Victoria Quay, and the postal address is Echo Hotel 6, 6 Quebec, Quebec.
To apply for an NEC card, you can submit an application online via the getyournec.scot portal.
Hopefully you will find some of this information useful. And Jill and I would like to wish you safe and happy journeys wherever you may wander.
Thank you for listening to Sound and Vision with Bob and Jill. Take care, and until the next time, it's goodbye from us both.
Hello, it's Roger, and another 10-question quiz. Okay, question one. Where are the Scottish Highland Games traditionally staged? Question two. Which famous London building stood from 1854 until 1936 when it was destroyed by fire? Question three. This is an odd one. What are rum, muck, and aig? I think it's pronounced. It's E-I-double-G. What are they? Question four. Casting your mind back some time. Which royal served on the ship HMS Cornwallis in World War II? Question five, still on the military world. What sort of thing is a Challenger 2? Question six. Which stadium is home to English Rugby Union? And these days, the odd pop concert. Question seven. What's the name of the Prime Minister's country residence? Question eight. Which city in England has a shopping area called the Bull Ring? The Bull Ring. Question nine. What was the date of D-Day in 1944? 1944. And finally, question 10. This sounds harder than it is. That's all I can say about this. What is the time and relative dimension in space better known as? Back soon with the answers. Roger, back with our quiz relating to 10 questions. First of all, where are the Scottish Highland Games staged? That's in Braemar. Braemar. Question 2. Which famous London building stood from 1854 until 1936? So not one of those destroyed in World War II. It was destroyed by fire in 1936, and that was the Crystal Palace. The Crystal Palace. Question 3. Muck, egg, and rum are Scottish islands. They are Scottish islands. Question 4. Which royal served during World War II on HMS Cornwallis? That was Prince Philip. Prince Philip. Question 5. A Challenger 2 is a tank. A tank. Question 6. Twickenham. Twickers is the home of English Rugby Union. Question 7. The Prime Minister's country residence is Chequers. Question 8. The city with a central shopping area known as the Bullring is Birmingham. Birmingham. Question 9. What's the date of D-Day? Or what was the date of D-Day back in 1944? That was June the 6th. June the 6th. And finally, the intriguing one, question 10. What is the time and relative dimension in space, better known as? Well, if you take the initial letters, it spells out Doctor Who's transport, the TARDIS. The TARDIS. Hope you enjoyed that. We'll be back another time with another quiz. Bye-bye.
TNS Soundings.